Welcome to In-Depth Studies Weekend. In-Depth Studies is the teaching ministry of Jeff Volker, which seeks to equip the believer with a theological foundation. All teaching is from the point of view of the doctrines of grace and New Covenant theology.
Welcome to another edition of In-Depth Studies Weekend. I'm Paul Honeycutt, joined as always by Jeff Volker, who is director of In-Depth Studies. Jeff, we've started to sort of unpack New Covenant theology. What is it? What makes it distinctive? Last week, we were talking about covenants. We looked at the Abrahamic covenant and the Noahic covenant. Where are we going today?
Well, we are going to move on to the Old Covenant, but let me give you a quick recap as to where we have been, just for the benefit of our listeners. New Covenant theology is really describes how the old relates to the new in Scripture, how Scripture falls together. And so we dealt with last week that just dealing with the issue of covenants, that first we dealt with the Noahic covenant, which is a covenant with all creation, which guaranteed the world would stay around until the Lord's plan of salvation was fully accomplished. And then we moved into the Abrahamic covenant, because there God's plan is for the first time in a clear way unfolded, and that is that God is going to have a people for himself and take them into a land to be with him forever. Now, when we looked at the Abrahamic covenant, we saw that in the context of the book of Genesis, Genesis 15, 17, etc., that the Abrahamic covenant is all about God giving Abraham physical descendants, first Isaac, then Jacob, then Jacob's 12 sons, 12 tribes of Israel, and take them into a land, Palestine, the promised land. And so from that point of view, the Abrahamic covenant, in effect, is all about the old covenant, because it's all about Israel and the promised land. But we also examined last week in Galatians chapter 3, where it looks at the promise of God providing a seed to Abraham as being fulfilled, truly fulfilled, not in Abraham's literal descendants, but in the one seed of Abraham is Jesus Christ. And so Jesus Christ going to the cross, dying on the cross, paying for the sins of all who are going to believe, and then taking them into a land that does not end, heaven, then new heavens and new earth. So this is the new covenant. And so that's really the overall model that we are operating from. And so this week, we want to now sort of focus our attention on the Old Covenant. And to do that, let's turn to Hebrews chapter 8, which is really the place where these issues are dealt with in great detail. But we're going to begin in verse 7, really deal with verses 7 and the first part of verse 8. Context, of course, we dealt with this last week, but let me repeat, just for the benefit of understanding. Book of Hebrews, you have these professed believers in Jesus who are Jewish, who were experiencing persecution over a prolonged period of time, and are now, for whatever reason, beginning to question whether or not they should shift their allegiance from the new covenant, Jesus, to the old covenant, go back under the Israelite model. And the author of Hebrews, of course, this is the book of Hebrews, says every aspect of the old covenant points to Jesus and the new covenant, and the old covenant, every part of the old covenant in and of itself doesn't do anything. It's just a picture. So with that in mind, let's pick up and read verses 7 and the first part of 8. For the author of Hebrews says, "For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God found fault with the people and said," then he says, "the time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." We will address that part of it later on. But we want to address in verse 7. First it says, "For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another." How? And of course, everybody would agree that the first covenant is the old or Mosaic covenant. There's no dispute about that. And remember, we talked about it last week, that we use this analogy of the football game, right? Whereas the Noahic covenant stands for the field upon which the game is going to be played, the game meaning God's plan of salvation. And then God's plan of salvation has two parts, Old Covenant, New Covenant, which we talked in terms of picture fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And so from the point of view of the game, that is that God is God's actual sort of unfolding of his plan of salvation, first there's the Old Covenant with Israel on Mount Sinai, and then, that, of course, that's going to be the picture, which we're going to discuss today. Then, of course, that prepares the way for the Messiah to come, Jesus Christ, who goes to the cross, and he actually accomplishes salvation, actually purchases a people, pays for their sins. That's the New Covenant. So now the question we asked last week was, why do they call the Old Covenant the First Covenant? And, of course, the answer is because in the unfolding of God's plan, first he's going to reveal the picture, which is literal Israel, literal land, Palestine. Then he's going to reveal the real thing, which is the New Covenant, the death of Jesus. But in verse 7, there is this strange phrase. It says, for if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. Well, everybody understands that God gave the Old Covenant or Mosaic Covenant to Israel on Mount Sinai. Now, how can a holy God who's absolutely perfect in all of his parts and everything he does, how can he give a covenant that something is wrong with, something faulty? Well, we know that that can't happen. But obviously, Hebrews 8:7 is God's word, holy true, so this has to have real meaning. And, of course, the answer is from the context of the book of Hebrews. Of course, the context is these professed believers who are Jewish, they are trying to, if they shift their allegiance from the new covenant to the old covenant, from Jesus to the covenant made with Israel, they are trying to get from that old covenant something that it was never intended to provide. That is, forgiveness of sins and a new heart, transformed life. And because the old covenant is never intended to provide that. Because it is a works covenant, not a gracious covenant, and it cannot produce believers, cannot pay for sins, cannot transform lives. So from that point of view, there was, if these professed Jewish believers are trying to use the Old Covenant to get their sins forgiven, then there's something wrong with it. That's, I think, what the author means.
So what you're saying, then, is that the Old Covenant, the Mosaic Covenant that God made with the nation of Israel through Moses, Mount Sinai, all that, that it was never intended to save a people.
Absolutely true.
And yet we do know there were some, a very small number, but there were some who were saved during that time. David, for example. On what basis was David saved?
And that's a great question, because we know there is always a remnant of believers in Israel that were there. And the answer is they are saved on the basis of the work of Christ to come, the new covenant. And because the old covenant can't save anybody, we're going to spend in the next number of weeks, we're going to explore this old covenant from a variety of angles. And we'll show that from the language of the New Testament in context, that it's not possible to view it as a covenant that saves, or what we would call a gracious covenant. It is a works, a legal covenant. So with that in mind, oh, by the way, we should point out, just in the first part of verse 8, that it says not only was there something wrong with that covenant, that is, they're trying to get something out of it that it was never given to produce, okay, forgiveness of sins and changed life, but verse 8 says, but God found fault with the people and said, then I'm going to make a new covenant. Well, the reason he says that is because if the old covenant is a works covenant, then it cannot produce believers. So that's why Israel, as a whole, is always viewed as unbelieving.
Well, it couldn't. The problem with the old covenant was it is a works covenant. Nobody could keep the works. Nobody could do it perfectly.
Well, absolutely true, because God is absolutely just and he's righteous, and therefore to be accepted by the God of heaven and earth on the basis of works, of course, you have to be perfection.
Right.
Okay, let's go back. Let's move now back to Exodus chapter 19. And let's examine what happened on Mount Sinai. And we'll go as far as we can. And then when we run out of time, we don't care. We'll just bring this to a close and we'll pick it up with the next program. Now, Exodus 19, the context, Moses has led the Israelites out of Egypt. Now they are in the Sinai Peninsula, and they're at the foot of Mount Sinai, also called Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. And so look at verse 3. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." Two things we want to point out. One, in verse 4, he says, you've seen how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you out of Egypt. So was God acting graciously to Israel? Absolutely. They didn't deserve it. He took them out of Egypt. But that's not the covenant. The covenant is, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. What he's saying is the covenant is perfect obedience. That's the covenant. And sometimes when we read this, as believers this side of Pentecost, this is how we tend to read it. Well, the evidence of a believer is a changed life that you want to obey, which is true. So when they're reading this, they say, ah, now if you desire to live for me, you desire to obey me, well, that means you're my people. That's not what this verse says in 19:5. This says, if you obey me fully and keep me and keep my covenant, that is perfectly, then I'll make you my people.
So, Jeff, it's not enough to want to obey. You have to obey. You have to fully obey.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The old covenant demands perfect obedience or God curses you. And I think it's a fundamental mistake that our fellow believers, let's say who embrace covenant theology, when they see this, they recognize that this is there, but their theological commitment of their system demands that they view it really as a gracious covenant. So sometimes you'll hear explanations like, it is a gracious covenant with legal implications. Mm. And we would say, no, God has been gracious to Israel, because we saw that. I brought you on eagle's wings out of Egypt. So they were unbelievers. They didn't deserve to be saved from Pharaoh, but he did. He brought them out. Grace is evident at every turn in the road. But the covenant, the old covenant, is not a gracious covenant. It is a works covenant. You got to obey fully.
So if it wasn't designed to save, it was designed to reveal sin.
Yes, and we're going to look next. We're going to stay in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy 28. But when we ask about then what was the purpose of the Old Covenant, we'll have to jump back to Galatians 3, because there it specifically addresses that question. But for now, let's go to Deuteronomy 28, because there's the context to this as Moses leads the Israelites right up to the promised land, to the Jordan, but of course the Lord is not going to allow Moses to enter the promised land. And so Joshua's going to lead them over. But before they go there, Moses instructs the Israelites, when you cross the Jordan, there's going to be these two mountains, Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim. You are to divide up Israel between these two mountains like an antiphonal choir, and you are to recite back and forth to each other the blessings and curses of the covenant. And that's what we find in Deuteronomy 28. And so let's just read sort of a portions of this, because it's very repetitive, but it does drive home the point. First, let's read the first six verses of Deuteronomy 28. By the way, just for our listeners' sake, we are always reading from the NIV, just so you know. If you fully obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all his commands I give you today, The Lord your God will set you high above all the nations on earth. All these blessings will come upon you and accompany you if you obey the Lord your God. You will be blessed in the city, blessed in the country. The fruit of your womb will be blessed, the crops of your land and the young of your livestock, the calves of your herds and the lambs of your flocks. Your basket and your kneading trough will be blessed. You will be blessed when you come in and blessed when you go out. So this is just a short snippet of a longer set of verses about if you obey fully, you get the blessings. But then if you drop down to verse 15, and let's read just a few of the verses there. It says, however, if you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I'm giving you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. You will be cursed in the city and cursed in the country. Your basket and your kneading trough will be cursed. The fruit of your womb will be cursed, and the crops of your land, and the calves of your herds, and the lambs of your flocks. You will be cursed when you come in and cursed when you go out. And just for icing on the cake, drop down to verse 44, because it's a continual litany of curses. You get to verse 45, and it says, all these curses will come upon you. They will pursue you and overtake you until you are destroyed because you did not obey the Lord your God and observe the commands and decrees he gave you.
Where's the wiggle room?
Yeah. Where's the grace? I mean, where is the grace in this thing? Because there isn't any. Because this is a legal covenant. It is works. And that is probably the most fundamental mistake that folks make when they go to the Old Covenant. Classic covenant theology will say that the Old Covenant is another administration of the one covenant of works. We would say, no, that's not true. And we're not questioning the hearts of our fellow believers who embrace covenant theology. That's crazy. No, this is an in-house debate among people who love Jesus Christ. But we do think they fundamentally miss what's going on in the Old Covenant. So this is a huge deal because it affects how you read all the rest of the Old Testament. Remember, most of our Bible is all about Israel, from Exodus, really, all the way through into the Gospels. It's all about Israel. And so to misunderstand this is a huge deal. So the two things we've examined, at least up to this point, are that the Old Covenant is called the First Covenant because first in the sense that first God is going to illustrate through a physical people and a physical land, what Jesus is actually going to accomplish on the cross, that is the purchase of a people from every tribe, nation, tongue, and take them into a land that does not end. Heaven, then the new heavens and new earth. Okay? And so, first, the Old Covenant is a picture. It's a picture. And therefore, we make a mistake if we think that Israel is the actual real people of God. They are a temporary, unbelieving picture of the people of God. So Israel, the whole Old Covenant era from let's say 1300 BC to the cross is preparatory, in preparation for the coming of the Messiah.
Yeah, how would you sell this? I mean, this well, we just read in Deuteronomy 28, you know, I've got a sales background, as you well know. You know, how do you take this to the marketplace and get a bunch of takers? I mean, you know, because again, it would be one thing if it said, do your best, you know, try as hard as you can, it's all going to be okay. That's not what this says in Deuteronomy 28. It says, fully obey all that I command. That's hard stuff.
Yeah, the idea, and this is something let's talk about for just a couple minutes here, is that what we are saying, it was not God's plan to save Israel as a whole. Mm-hmm. It was never his plan. That they were to function in his plan as a temporary, unbelieving picture of the people of God. And so at this point, I think we need to go back to the teaching passages of the New Covenant era. So let's go back to Galatians chapter 3, because here we have a commentary. And last week we read verses really 15 through 16, where it described that the Abrahamic covenant is actually talking about the work of Christ, which if you just read Genesis 15, 17, et cetera, you would, I don't think that's what you would come up with at all. And so let's pick it up in verse 17. Because here we have this commentary, and we should understand that Galatians 3 and 4, these two chapters, provide a historical defense or explanation as to the purpose of the Mosaic Law and the Old Covenant, because the Mosaic Law is part of the Old Covenant, the purpose of that in God's plan of salvation. Mm-hmm. That's what we're dealing with. So verse 17 says this, "What I mean is this, the law, Mosaic Law, introduced 430 years later," okay, that is after the Abrahamic covenant, so Mount Sinai, 430 years after God gives the covenant to Abraham, "does not set aside the covenant previously established by God and thus do away with the promise," meaning that, okay, the old covenant is works, but the Abrahamic covenant is ultimately all about the work of Christ. First, they're going to describe the work of Christ in terms of physical picture. Physical people, Israel, physical land, Palestine. But that's just a picture of the work of Christ on the cross, which is all about purchasing a real people and taking them into a land that doesn't end. So if the old covenant is works, well, then the Abrahamic covenant is all about the work of Christ, which is grace. And so you say, well, this sounds sort of odd because one is grace, one's works. But they say, wait a second, it doesn't set aside the God's plan to save people by grace. It doesn't do that. Then it says, for if the inheritance depends on the law, depends on what you do, then it no longer depends on a promise, because a promise is grace. It's a gift. But God in his grace gave it to Abraham through a promise. So he's just reasserting that, no. Salvation is going to come through grace. Verse 19 says, what then was the purpose of the law? Which is what we would say. Because now that this question has added importance in the book of Galatians, because remember that the problem that Paul's addressing in the church of Galatia was guys from Jerusalem came down and said, believing in Jesus and his death on the cross, that's necessary for salvation, but it's not enough. You must also obey the Mosaic Law, get circumcised, etc., in order to be saved, to be justified. And of course, Paul's argument is, guys, if you understood the historical purpose of the Mosaic Law as part of the Old Covenant, you would have never tried to bring it into the New Covenant era. It doesn't belong in that era because it is inextricably tied to the Old Covenant, and which is a works covenant. So if you're bringing the Mosaic Law into the New Covenant era, you are bringing a works covenant to people. And of course, the language he uses in the book of Galatians is, if you do this, you have fallen from grace, meaning you're going to go to hell because now you're basing your salvation upon works. So he says, what then was the purpose of the law? It was added because of transgressions until the seed to whom the promise referred had come. Now, what does that mean? It was added because of transgressions. And the only place we need to go really is Romans 5:20. And here we'll just sort of address this initially. We will finish this up in our program next week. But in Romans 5:12 through 21, they're discussing the method God uses to save us, which is representation. And Jesus represents on the cross, us on the cross. We get what he accomplished, just as Adam represented us in the Garden of Eden. He sinned, we're blamed for his sin. But in verse 20 of that, it says, the law was added so that the trespass might increase. So what does that mean? And in context, it's obvious. He says, okay, the Mosaic Law, which was the first formal giving of law, when that was given so that sin would increase. And the idea is this, is that we are guilty because of Adam's sin, but we don't know that. That's a theological concept. So how do we know we need a Savior? We have to know we're a sinner. Well, then how do we become a sinner? Well, he gives us his law, Mosaic Law. He gives it to Israel, which is an unbelieving people. We will discuss this in more detail next week in Romans 7:5. When God's law confronts an unbelieving heart, our evil passions are aroused. We sin more, not less. So when God gives his law to Israel, it increases their sin because their hearts are bad, because they're unbelievers. And This is what why the Old Covenant was given. It was to be a 1,500-year illustration of the futility of trying to be accepted by God on the basis of what you do. That never works. And so he illustrated it for 1,500 years.
Good stuff. I'm looking forward to next week.
If you have any questions about today's program, want more information, or would like to support our ministry, you can find us on the web at IDS.org or call us at 480-924-4294 or email Jeff at jeff.volker@IDS.org.